Thanks for coming. Ellie's just setting up. I think we're going to record this. We can make the recording announcement. We try to record meetings so that we can post them on our website afterwards. So you should feel free to speak freely. And if there's anything that you say that you would want excised from the recording, we can do that after the event. So just mention it when you're speaking or come see me afterwards.
Cool. All right, well, thanks everyone for coming. Thanks, Eliza, for the welcome. Appreciate that. Just before we get started, I wanted to make sure everyone knew who the GiveWell-related people here are. So Eliza is a research analyst at GiveWell. She's been here at GiveWell for a couple of years. And this is Tom Rutledge. He's our board chair. Since a long time, you've been on the GiveWell board, so a long-standing supporter. And I'm Ellie Hassenfeld. I'm the co-founder and co-executive director of GiveWell. The basic plan for this evening is to have an informal conversation about the research that we're doing. The goal is to bring you all into the sort of the research room that we have where we're trying to decide what to do. So a lot of the questions that we're going to talk about are ones where we don't yet have final answers, but they're really the challenges that we're sort of currently facing as we go through our research process. So there's basically going to be two parts to this event. First, I'll give a brief overview of the work that we're currently doing on our traditional focus on GiveWell top charities, which is organizations implementing evidence-backed programs that serve the global poor. And then we'll pause and we'll have a little bit of time for some questions. And then we'll move on to an overview of what we're working on with GiveWell Labs, which is our newer, more open-ended research process, and then have some time for questions about that. And then, you know, Eliza and I, and maybe Tom, we don't know, are happy to hang around afterwards and answer any questions one-on-one that people have. So I'll dive into to sort of our traditional work on GiveWell top charities. So, you know, this is the part of GiveWell that looks for the, you know, most quantifiable evidence-backed programs, and they're always working in the developing world. So these are programs like deworming pills to kill parasitic infections, bed nets to prevent malaria, and this is the thing that is most in evidence on our website. The biggest change in the last year on this side of GiveWell's work is that we grew pretty substantially, our staff size did, over the past year. We went from a full-time staff of 5 to a full-time staff of 11, and so our plans for what we're going to do on the GiveWell traditional side are significantly more aggressive in 2014 than they were in 2013. And so there's basically three parts to this research. There's following up on past top charities to see how they're doing. So these are groups that have received significant funds as a result of our recommendation. There's trying to find new charities. And then there's some, I'd call it somewhat new experimental work we're doing to try and support the creation of new future GiveWell top charities. So there aren't so far many updates on our top charities from where they were at the end of last year. I'd say the biggest news is that the Against Malaria Foundation, which was our top recommendation for 2 years, they were our recommendation from the end of 2011 to the end of 2013. And we took them down because they had been unable to find a place to distribute, to spend most of their funds. And we felt that they had sufficient funding and didn't need additional funding at the time. In the last few weeks, they've committed to a distribution in the Democratic Republic of the Congo that accounts for about $2 million of the $14 million they currently have. So this is good news. We're optimistic that AMF is moving in the right direction with finalizing distributions. But we're not yet ready to put them back on our top charities list because we're still, you know, watching and waiting to see what they do. GiveDirectly received more than $10 million based on GiveWell's recommendation last year. As far as we know, based on our recent conversations, they seem on track to distribute it. And there's no major updates from the other two top charities. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the new areas we're looking for additional top charities in. So I'm just going to kind of go cause by cause. One of the areas that, you know, we're looking at is the program called salt iodization. So this is where people fortify salt with iodine. This is something that the evidence base that this program has an impact is pretty strong. If you have a severe level of iodine deficiency, there's strong evidence that reducing that deficiency leads to people not having very significant cognitive impairment. And when people have more moderate deficiency, the fortifying their salt with iodine leads to improvements in more like moderate level improvements in cognitive development as measured by IQ. This is a program that was pretty much rolled out across the developed world a long time ago. There was reasonable success rolling it out in the developing world in the 80s and 90s. And some of what we've heard from the groups that we've spoken with is that now donors are fatigued with salt iodization and to some extent feel like the job is complete and have moved on to other causes like AIDS or malaria. And that has left this cause, which is extremely promising, without sufficient funding to fully complete the job that was there. So, you know, this is something we're still in progress on. I wouldn't say we've fully vetted that particular story, but there are two groups that we're looking at in salt iodization. One is ICCIDD, which I think stands for the International Council for the Control of Iodine Deficiency Disorders. They're basically a network of academics. And what they do is they advocate and provide technical assistance to governments in their implementation of salt iodization. So that can be convincing them that they should do this if they're not already doing so, or providing answers to questions when the government finds out that there's some problem in their iodization scheme. You know, the people from ICCIDD are there to provide support. So this is this is definitely a different type of group than the ones that GiveWell has traditionally recommended. They're not a direct service organization, they're advocacy, but they seem to be a group that, you know, could plausibly be playing a very big role in salt iodization. The other group is called GAIN. They're the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. They're funded heavily by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they run a wide variety of nutrition programs. But we're looking at them specifically for iodization, and where ICCIDD focuses more on the, I'd say, high-level advocacy and research support, GAIN is more involved in a more direct advisory level, helping governments with things like ensuring that the quality assurance checks on the salt that is iodized are appropriate and that they can determine that they've iodized salt sufficiently. Certainly a challenge that we'll face with GAIN is because they run so many programs, there's always the question of whether a donation to the program itself supports more of the program itself or is fungible with other activities of that organization. But you know, given the state where, you know, GiveWell is today, we think that this problem of figuring out how to work with organizations that run many programs is an important question for us to tackle. We're also looking at a new organization that's part of the family of causes known as neglected tropical diseases. So two of our charities now are deworming organizations. That's one set of neglected tropical diseases. This organization, which is known as the Center for Neglected Tropical Diseases, actually focuses on lymphatic filariasis, whose worst negative impact is a swelling of the limbs through elephantiasis that leads to severe disability. People are basically incapable of moving around. This again, like in many ways, fits the bill for a potential GiveWell top charity. And so we're looking closely at them. And then finally, we're revisiting organizations that focus on immunizations. We looked at this 2 years ago, and a lot of what we found then was that it didn't seem that money was the core bottleneck to immunizing more people. Only about 80% of people are fully immunized worldwide, so there certainly is room to get there, but it didn't seem like it was a direct funding bottleneck. We want to revisit that conclusion again, and so we're doing so looking at a few organizations, UNICEF's tetanus immunization campaign, a measles and rubella initiative, and then also this campaign to roll out the meningitis A vaccine, which is new and was funded, the development of which was funded by the Gates Foundation. Another particular challenge with immunizations is that a lot of the cost effectiveness of the program is heavily dependent on local conditions. And that's information we would need from the charity itself. So just to give an example quickly, the way the maternal and neonatal tetanus initiative works is that they provide a supplemental immunization to all women of childbearing age. And the problem is that the need for this program varies widely depending on whether or not those women have already been immunized. If they have been, you're not getting a very much benefit. If they haven't been, you're getting a great deal of benefit. And routine immunization rates vary very widely across the world. Similarly, tetanus is something that is a worse problem in hospitals that are unclean and less of a problem in hospitals that are very clean. And so the likely impact of reducing tetanus or reducing the possibility of transmitting tetanus is going to depend on the levels of tetanus in that community, excluding the immunization. And so this will be a challenge of looking at each of these entities if we get to that point. The final area of our work is this, what I refer to as a more experimental part of our process, which is trying to support the creation of new GiveWell top charities. And so we've done a couple of things there so far. First is we've you know, when I say we, I often mean GiveWell and in working in consort with Good Ventures, which is a foundation we work very closely with. Good Ventures provided a grant to an organization called New Incentives. And New Incentives runs a conditional cash transfer program in Nigeria with the goal of reducing mother-to-child transmission of HIV. If mothers meet the conditions, then they receive a cash transfer. This organization is extremely young. They're like a year old. They have basically no track record to speak of. But they are implementing a priority program. They seem transparent to us. And so we're experimenting with the idea of providing them some upfront support as with the goal of having a new top charity 5 years from now. The other side of this, so one side of it is organizations implementing priority programs. The other side is the evidence base. What programs have sufficient evidence behind them? And so the other thing that we've been trying to do is support the groups that run rigorous trials of development programs to see if we can add to the evidence base that certain programs are effective. And so we've talked to Innovations for Poverty Action, which is the research group at Yale that runs the randomized controlled trials. And we've also talked to a younger, smaller group that instead of focusing on, I would say, purely academic research with a development focus, they work more closely with organizations on the ground to design evaluations of their programs that can, to evaluate whether or not they're working. And so we're hopeful that through this process, you know, and I'm happy to sort of go into this more and the details of the programs that we're most interested in learning more about, you know, we're hoping that this leads to additional GiveWell top charities down the line, because certainly something that we feel we've run into over the last few years is a lack of organizations that are running the programs that we think have the strongest evidence behind them. So I want to pause there. That's kind of an overview of what's currently going on the traditional side of our research, and answer any questions that you have about that. Yep.
How are you looking to evaluate, for instance, the charity, the one that's doing the iodine, the research and support side? What sort of metrics are you looking to evaluate whether that, on the cost effectiveness side for that?
Yeah. So, you know, the main things that we're looking at there, I mean, so our research process is basically divided into two parts. There's research on the intervention, which is like, how good would it be if we accomplish salt iodization? What do we generally know about the costs? What can we say about how often these programs work? And that is totally external to the organization itself. And so we've done that for, you know, all of our top charities, BedNets, Cash, that exists. And then the other side is assessing the organization itself. And I think in this case, a lot of what we'll be looking at is, you know, what can we learn about their track record? And by track record, I mean like our best understanding of the significance of the role that they played in salt iodization historically. We'll also try and talk to other people who are not them, you know, to like triangulate what role they played. I don't think we're going to be able to get to the point of turning, like having a very credible estimate of like their dollars in and like what comes out, because clearly they're like one tiny part of the process. And I think like the way that we'll end up thinking about cost effectiveness is what are the total expenditures that are necessary for implementing salt iodization, and what is the total benefit, and then trying to determine whether or not we're convinced that they play a significant role.
Thanks.
Yep.
This model seems very similar to the one that's used by Google in the world. And it seems like it has the same set of challenges in terms of figuring out what the cost effectiveness is. Do you feel that the role of ICC, IDD, or GAN is similar to DTW? And if the challenges are also the same?
Yeah, so I'm going to repeat the question just for the recording. I skipped this one because you were close. So the question is, you know, how does ICC IDD compare to Deworm the World, which, or ICC IDD and GAIN compare to Deworm the World, which is a charity we've already recommended? You know, I think in many ways it's similar in that they're not the direct service provider; they're an advocate. But I am, you know, I don't think I'm not confident that the type of advocacy they provide is at all similar. So, you know, Deworm the World is, you know, we have a decent understanding of the role that they're playing. They're, like, very involved in the Indian states where they work and provide a great deal of support, you know, often are even providing funding for essential parts of the program, like monitoring or training or surveying to determine where deworming is needed. And, you know, ICC IDD, by contrast, is much further away from what's going on the ground. They're, you know, a network of academics. I don't think any of them are full-time employed by ICC IDD. Their total annual budget, you know, up through this year was about $1 million a year. You know, they think they lost some funding because of some changes in Australia, and they're like, they think they can expand, but they are acting at like a much higher level in some sense in the process than Deworm the World is. And so that will be its own new challenge for us. You know, we've talked least to GAIN so far, so it's difficult to say exactly what role they play. My instinct so far is that it's closer to what Deworm the World does, where the big challenge with, you know, with GAIN will really be this issue that they run so many programs, and we'll really have to be sure that funding coming into their iodization program causes that program to expand as opposed to something. Yeah.
Are you concerned about, since you'll be funding, you know, future or top charities, are you concerned about your ability to remain unbiased and ability to judge how effective these organizations are that you might have a personal stake in just because you're given a meeting?
Yeah, so the question is whether we'll be, you know, whether we think we'll stay unbiased when organizations we supported from the beginning are ones that we're considering for recommendation. You know, I think it's a good question. You know, it's not something that I'm terribly concerned about, nor is it something I think you should be terribly concerned about. I mean, I think we have a pretty good track record of critically assessing the judgments that we previously made and being open to saying where things went wrong. You know, and I think, you know, you see that with what happened with, I mean, all the way back, PSI and Village Reach and AMF and SCI. So, you know, I think we have a, and so we have a good track record of that. You know, it's also something that's really built into the DNA of GiveWell, which is, you know, critically assessing the information that we have and being open about it, as opposed to trying to confirm that what we previously thought is correct or, like, protect our position as someone who is a group that has good judgments. You know, that said, I think it's also the case that none of, I mean, I wouldn't bet that our, you know, I wouldn't guess that our bet on new incentives will work out. You know, if I was just trying to say, like, is it more likely than not that new incentives will become a top charity? I'm hopeful that they will. But I think that's, like, really, really hard. And they're at the very beginning. And so I think what is most likely is that, you know, we and they learn a lot about the difficulties in creating a new top charity. I mean, I certainly think they may. But I don't know. I'm pretty sure that will be a function of the merits rather than something else. Yep.
So how many people are affected by the iodization of the salt? Like, how large is this population?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know. So the question is, how many people are affected by the salt iodization problem?
There's a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
Compared to other...
So it's still a very large problem. I mean, there are... So you can go on, like, UNICEF's website, because UNICEF is the one that does the surveying for determining the extent of iodine deficiency. And there are countries where, you know, large proportions of the population are iodine deficient. And so this is one of the main questions that we have as we entered this cause 3 months ago. I think the thing we thought was most likely to happen is that we would find that this problem was more or less already solved, or at least solved in a way where additional money wouldn't make a difference. And as we've talked to people and actually looked at the data, we see multiple large countries where there are still significantly deficient populations. And importantly, the Gates Foundation has provided a lot of funding to, I think it's 15 or so very high population countries. So like India, Ethiopia, Nigeria are countries where the Gates Foundation is very involved, because clearly if you can get a country to iodize all their salt, then you want to be working in the country with the largest population. But there are countries like, I believe, Madagascar, Angola, that have been, you know, have do not have significant activity going on.
You talked about AMF and how you had removed them from your list because from your top charities list because of lack of funding. Is there any worry that charities in that situation may be more aggressive than they should be in trying to spend some of their existing money in order to get, because they know that if they do that, they can get back on that top charities list and potentially increase their money coming in?
Yeah, so it's certainly, you know, the possibility of creating an incentive for charities to spend money unwisely is like a dangerous one. And the metric of, the simple metric of have you spent money is not, I don't think, is a great one. Mm-hmm. You know, we thought about this some with AMF specifically. I think, you know, based on what we know about them, I think they were very, very unlikely to take the message away, like, we should spend money more easily, as opposed to like, all right, we got to find a way to get this done, or like return money to donors is something I think, you know, they were even talking about. I definitely think it's something we've talked about for like other organizations that we know less well. And it's certainly like a big part of the, and I think it's a big part of our update process. It's like, we not only want to see that the money was spent, but like, was the money spent well? Did you do things, like, going in, we have some understanding of what groups intend to do with additional funds. So, you know, did this group spend money in a way that was consistent with what they said they would do? And does it seem to have been effective? I mean, those are the questions we're, you know, trying to answer.
Relatedly, for AMF, one of the criticisms I think they've heard of your being delisted as a recommended charity is the idea that they need a large amount of cash in order to keep their pipeline fully funded, because mm-hmm. they can't enter negotiations with a counterparty if they can't commit to delivering on that negotiation ultimately at the end. And there's a risk that all of the people that they're currently talking to could result in distributions, therefore they can't start talking to anybody new until those existing conversations are finished, either resulting in a distribution or not a distribution. Mm-hmm. And so because they don't have this buffer of cash, they don't have the ability to start more conversations and keep their pipeline fully populated.
Yeah.
So, you know, do you have any comment on that?
Yeah. So, I think it's a really good question. You know, put very simply, it's, you know, is it appropriate to for AMF not to be recommended because they need to have money in the bank to be able to negotiate with countries? And they're now, I mean, they've told us, like, this is in these, you know, page we published within the last month. You know, they're explicitly not trying to build out a deeper pipeline because they're not sure that they would have money in the bank at the point they got there. You know, I think the situation with AMF is like this. You know, when they first got a recommendation from us in 2011, they completed their like biggest distribution to date, which was about $1 million worth of nets. And then since then, they hadn't been able to finalize any distributions. And so I think that, you know, there's like some level of concern that AMF will just not be able to negotiate through the challenges of working with the governments and in the WHO and the UNICEF the way that is, you know, operating at a scale in negotiation that's very different than what they were doing before. That's why I think this first distribution that they agreed to is like definitely a good sign that there can be some movement there. But I mean, it's still a lot smaller than the amount of funds that they have. And so I think that like what we really want to see is successfully negotiating a large distribution, you know, using up, let's say, like more than half of their funds. And then at that point, we would say, like, we shouldn't be we shouldn't ask AMF to always like draw down its bank account every year. That would be a very like unreasonable thing to expect, and I think detrimental to their progress. But instead say AMF now has something of a track record of being able to negotiate large scale distributions. Now we expect that we'll have to wait, and there'll be a timeline and a lag of money in and distributions out, and that is what we'd be ready to see them build up.
Do you think there's any possibility of setting up some kind of trust where AMF could draw that money if they had a distribution that they could commit to, but then they wouldn't get it unless they actually were able to finalize it?
Yeah, so I mean, Ian's asking this question of like whether you could set up some vehicle where you accomplish a goal of providing AMF with money if it needed it without, you know, directly giving them the money. So I've personally talked about this with Rob Mather, who's the AMF's CEO, and so this is definitely something we're like open to considering. I think that like this is a possibility. I think if people were really interested in it, you know, they could execute this on their own by giving to a donor advised fund and telling Rob what they were doing or telling us what they were doing. I think it's also the case that a dynamic we saw among our donor base, you know, the donors who use our research last year, you know, in 2013, because most people tend to give in the last month of the year. So something we saw is that a lot of people didn't give as much as they had previously, or didn't give at all and held back their charity for the year, or gave into a donor advised fund. And I think a lot of this was explicitly with the intention of waiting a year to see what happened with AMF. And giving to AMF at the end of 2014, if they're still top rated and they need the money. But I do think it's an important point because, often in charity, there's the organizations sometimes have a cash flow issue where they literally need the money in the bank. And sometimes they just have like a planning issue where they need to know that donors are there for them if they need it. And, I think a lot of good can be done by donors just being very explicit with organizations about what they intend to do with their donations.
It sounds to me like you're saying a lot of people are doing this anyway by waiting. So if AMF is unable to start a pipeline because they don't have the committed money, and there's also all these people that are waiting to give, like it just seems like all the pieces are there except the actual...
Yeah, I don't know how... I mean, the question with this waiting is like exactly how much it adds up to and, what's there. I mean, I think... I also think just practically speaking, AMF... knows what our position is. Like, we're not trying, we're trying to be very transparent with them. And so if this is something that we could be helpful to them by moving on, we would try to. Yeah. Any other?
Yeah. So you mentioned a little bit about your challenge of trying to evaluate how larger organizations, whether it's a Gates Foundation or those kind of organizations that may be doing a very good work, but say it's so large that say it's very difficult to evaluate the effectiveness. I read about like sometimes, like I say, even larger organizations, the money they have is still very small compared with the size of all the problems in the world. And then there are some like experiments in terms of capital aggregation amongst the different kind of organizations. So are you trying to see, for sometimes is it the case that you evaluate, say, Gates Foundation or some other foundation who take money from individual donors, and then if they are very effective, but the scale of the problem is such that they would also need more money, that you may somehow figure out a way to recommend them?
I see. So I think your question is, is sort of being large as an organization itself a sufficient reason to not recommend an organization? Because certainly you could have a very large organization that is trying to tackle a problem that's even larger than right. its resources. We do face challenges investigating large organizations just because of the fact that they're very large. We want to understand the details of what's going on in an organization's activities, and the larger they are, the harder it is to find a group that is able to communicate with us in a way that we can learn well. I think like one of the specific ways that that challenge plays out is the larger the organization, the more likely it is that they're more nervous about what a GiveWell report will say about them. It also means we often are talking to communication staff relative to program staff, which is just a sort of a specific challenge that you face when dealing with a larger entity. When I talk about larger organizations, though, there's also this issue that we face, which is that they implement many different types of programs. And so if you think about, not to pick on UNICEF, but if you just take UNICEF as an example, they run health programs that I'm sure have great evidence behind them. They also run programs that I'm sure do not have as much evidence, like an education program or other types of programs. And it's really difficult to know where the marginal dollar is going in that very large entity. And it's not just a function of the fact that they're large. It's a function of the fact that they're so diversified that you really are not, you're kind of throwing your money into the pot of this extremely diverse entity, and you don't know where it will end up. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is what, kind of more specifics on what we're thinking about in this funding groups that are doing the randomized control trials. That's an area where we're really only focused on supporting very specific research. We went to them and said, broadly speaking, we would like to support additional research that adds to the evidence base about a program. Are there programs that you think are most worthy of additional research? And they sent us some ideas. And then, we also have some understanding of the evidence base currently. And so we said, here are some programs that we're particularly interested in. And so the programs now that we're most interested in seeing more evidence on are programs where there's basically a single randomized controlled trial that found a great effect in one location. And we're just really curious how generalizable that effect is. And so the programs are incentives for vaccines, which is basically giving women who bring their children to be vaccinated a bag of rice or something as an incentive to get their child vaccinated. This had great results in a single trial in India. Hasn't been replicated as far as I know. Incentives for migration, which is giving people some money and saying, hey, you can seasonally migrate within this country and earn a lot more if you migrate from rural to urban areas. And then there's an eyeglasses study in China where giving out eyeglasses to students resulted in significantly higher test scores, basically. So that's another one we're considering. And then finally, there's been a study of commitment savings devices in the Philippines. And so that's sort of a fourth one that we're talking about. I think a lot of what we'll end up deciding what we move forward with is largely a function of what the organizations think they can pull off. Like, can they find a partner who wants to implement it? Is there an academic who's interested in researching this program as part of their academic career? So that's what we're looking at. Cool, so I wanna pause here and just move on to the sort of the second half, the GiveWell Labs side of things. And so again, I'll just kind of give a brief overview of what we're doing and then we can pause for questions and also leave some time for any other questions that people have at the end. So just one quick note on GiveWell Labs is I spend more of my time personally on the things we've already talked about. So I'm not as involved in all of the details of GiveWell Labs, and so it's possible that I won't be able to answer some of your questions, but I will certainly try. So GiveWell Labs is the more open-ended side of GiveWell. It's where we're dropping the criteria of, dropping the evidence-based criterion that is so important to our traditional work. And we started GiveWell Labs a couple years ago for a couple reasons. One was that the types of recommendations GiveWell's traditional work was making didn't seem well suited to the very largest philanthropists. These are people who could start organizations from scratch if they wanted to because they have sufficient funds. And so we wanted to have a research product that was helpful to that type of donor. And we're working closely with this foundation, Good Ventures, which is they're the sort of primary short-term consumer of this research. The other reason is that GiveWell's mission is to find the best giving opportunities we can. And I think those giving opportunities could easily be high risk, high reward opportunities as opposed to strong evidence of impact opportunities. And so that's why we're looking at it. One of the ways that GiveWell Labs differs most concretely from our traditional work is the traditional work focuses on the unit of the charity. You know, is this charity good implementing a specific program? And GiveWell Labs focuses at the cause level, where we're instead asking, is this a cause that we should get involved in? There's a few reasons for this. One of the main ones is that, you know, again, if you imagine being able to start an organization, you don't want to be limited to the organizations that exist. You want to know about areas that may need to have new organizations created. And I think, you know, this is actually something that philanthropists, I think, have done reasonably well over the years, finding an area that is getting insufficient attention from the world and bringing more attention to it. The other part of this is, without the criterion of evidence base as this key thing you go on, having more context in an area where you really have committed to a cause, understand a cause, I think puts us in a better position to separate the better from the worse proposals that we see. So generally, you know, on a substantive level, we're sort of separating the GiveWell Labs world into four categories of causes. Two of which we haven't put much time into so far, though we've put some, and I can talk about it if anyone's real interested: scientific research and foreign aid. Obviously, foreign aid is in some ways covered by GiveWell's traditional work, but you know, we're also looking at it for labs. So both of those are areas where we haven't done very much yet. The two areas where we have put more time into are politics, which is influencing laws, regulations in the U.S. We've primarily focused here so far, though that wouldn't be something that was necessary long term. And then also global catastrophic risks. You know, these are things that have a very low probability of some very bad outcome for humanity. Where we are right now with both of those causes, and I'll go into more specifics, is that in 2014, our goal is to commit to a few causes in those super causes or those categories by the end of the year, with, you know, in order to put ourselves in a position to, you know, we think committing is necessary in order to learn about what we can do in the cause and what the opportunities look like. So we've done a lot of work that is relatively high level, comparing between causes, and this appears on our website. But, you know, a challenge that you have in philanthropy is it's not like all of the good ideas are just out there and you can kind of go through them all and compare them to each other. Instead, you often need to commit money and staff time to an area and say, like, we are a funder here, in order for the best ideas to come out of the closet and, you know, come to you and be assessed. So what this commitment really means for us is, like, hopefully by the end of the year we're in a position where we can say, here are some areas where we're committing a significant amount of full-time staff and, you know, something like $5 to $10 million a year for a few years to this cause. And we hope that that type of commitment enables us to get these learning benefits from these areas. And so I say learning benefits because these are not the causes that we have decided are necessarily the best long-term. We're trying to pick causes that certainly now seem very promising to us, but are ones where we expect that the learning that we'll have over the next 3 years will put us in the best position to learn more in the future. So now I just want to go through some of the specific causes that we're thinking most about. So the first area is politics. And, you know, there we've gone through a very long process of, you know, talking to what I would call general people with general policy knowledge about which areas seem most promising. Also then, you know, going through a whole list of causes to assess them on what are our key questions, I'd say, in GiveWell Labs. And so these questions are, how important is the cause? Meaning, if you were to have an impact, how good would that impact be? What would it mean in humanitarian terms? How tractable is the cause? Is this something where you could realistically imagine having this impact? And then finally, how crowded is the cause? Is there already significant funding in that area, with the notion that to the extent that there is more funding, that likely reduces the marginal value of additional funding? Now, obviously, all of these sort of interplay with each other. A cause could be crowded in a certain way that's low impact, but very uncrowded at a higher impact. But conceptually, these are the types of questions we're trying to ask. So I'll go through the three areas of politics that we've spent the most time on so far and are sort of closest to committing to. So one is criminal justice reform. This is an issue that was highlighted to us this is in the United States, and the goal here is reducing prison population and increasing safety. And this was highlighted to us as a cause that is particularly tractable at the moment. So it sort of stands out among other causes for the potential for making a difference. And the reason is that for a long time, the left has been very interested in reducing the prison population for humanitarian reasons. The right has been known, I guess, more for tough on crime, increasing surveillance and increasing prison population. But more recently, as states have faced budget crises, this has also become an issue of where states can save money by reducing prison population. And so it has something of a transpartisan consensus, perhaps. What we have largely done so far is fund a couple, and when I say we again, this is Good Ventures providing funding, fund academics who are working on this area. One of them is a guy named Mark Kleiman. He has some of the more, insightful or informative views on criminal justice reform that we've seen. One of the main ideas that he's well known for is the idea of swift and certain sanctions, which means trying to deter crime not by increasing the severity of the punishment that is meted out, but instead making sure that people are swiftly and consistently punished for that crime. And there was a randomized controlled trial of this program. It had pretty promising results. The idea is we don't need to have people in jail for as long to get the same public safety goals that we have. Another thing that he is well known for is promoting the idea that we need to better regulate alcohol. There's a lot of talk about legalization of drugs, and he has worked with Washington State on rolling out their legal pot initiative. But on the other hand, he's saying there's other substances that are abused. Alcohol is one that causes a great deal of crime, and we should do what we can to try and better regulate that area. The other academic that we've supported is a woman named Angela Hawken at Pepperdine University, and she's trying to provide states with the tools to evaluate their own programs rigorously through randomized controlled trials. And so we've supported this initiative called BetaGov, that's Angela Hawken's group. And then finally, we're kind of talking a lot to a relatively large public charity that has a criminal justice program. This is more explicitly political. They work pretty closely with state governments. They take a more technocratic approach to the work that they're doing, where they're finding small ways to tweak laws that they hope can reduce prison populations while maintaining public safety. We've also talked a lot with them and maybe providing funding to their efforts. The other two causes are definitely on the side of potential for very large impact and probably not particularly tractable. So one is a cause we call labor mobility, which is trying to enable people from poor countries to migrate to richer countries. This is something that Michael Clemens, who's an economist at the Center for Global Development, he'll point to this as the best poverty alleviation program that we know of. And he has an estimate that open borders would lead to a 2x, two times increase in world GDP. We looked at the numbers. I don't think we would stand behind that estimate, but I certainly think the notion behind it is sound, that you take someone who's living in Haiti and they move to the US, and if they can find a minimum wage job, that has a unbelievable impact on their standard of living. This is definitely like a controversial issue. It's one where there's a lot of battles going on right now in government on immigration reform. And so the interest we have in it is that we don't see others making the humanitarian case for more open immigration laws. And we don't see any philanthropy to speak of on that side of the debate. And so that seems like a potential interesting opportunity for impact. The final politics area where we're kind of most seriously considering going into, and there's a longer list of causes on our website, is macroeconomic policy. So this is an area where you know, global recessions cause a significant amount of financial harm in the rich world and in the poor world. And if recessions could be better managed, you could have a very big impact on, you know, on humanitarian outcomes. It's definitely, so there's a few things, there's a lot of things that are unclear in this area. It's unclear how crowded it is, first. I mean, there's academic research done on macroeconomics. The groups like the Federal Reserve fund their own research. But there certainly is no major philanthropist that has macroeconomics as their policy area. And so that, in some ways, is a sign of a lack of uncrowdedness. It's also the case that, so then there's also this question about what would you do in this area? You know, I think this is something we're still trying to learn more about, but, you know, certainly in the conversations we've had with economists, a couple things have come out. I think you could potentially fund more practical research that helps us better know what to do in recessions. There's also possible that you could fund improved communications such that the government were able to undertake the policies that would be likely most effective. You know, obviously this is a very, like, controversial, it's a challenging environment. There's no notion here or with labor mobility that these would be particularly easy. They're particularly hard, for sure, but the lack of philanthropic involvement and the potential for very large impact makes them, you know, appealing to us as causes to investigate further. The last area I just want to touch on briefly is this area of global catastrophic risks. So these are things, I think the example that people might know most about is like an asteroid could hit the Earth, and that could cause, you know, the extinction of humanity. It's very unlikely that this happens, but if it did happen, that would be really bad. This is the type of activity that philanthropy seems particularly well-suited to supporting. This is not something that a market actor will take care of. It's possible that governments would take care of this. I think in the case of asteroids, it's, you know, significantly less promising than it might seem on its face, because NASA has done a pretty good job of this over the last 20 years of identifying the larger asteroids that are out there. But there are causes that, you know, seem to us particularly scary and don't have much philanthropic involvement. And so these are biosafety. So then this would be like bioterror or flu pandemics, and trying to find ways to reduce these risks. There's a lot of government funding in this. You know, there's about $6 billion a year on biosafety, but it tends to focus mostly on bioterror. And I think our understanding is less on things like pandemics. And so conceivably, you could support activities like improved research on the potential magnitudes of the impacts or better ways to mitigate the potential for a pandemic. Another area is geoengineering. So this is coming up with technology that allows us to cool the climate in the event that we have a sort of disaster climate change scenario. This is something where, again, very little philanthropy is there, less than $10 million a year. It's something that is particularly controversial because by funding this type of technology, you might reduce the incentive for carbon emission reduction. You know, it's also possible that by developing this technology, a country could get hold of it, implement it, and then cause some sort of global war over the technology. And so a lot of, you know, these are the questions that we're thinking about as we look into this cause. And one angle on this cause that we find particularly interesting is an angle of management or safe management of emerging technologies, which, you know, also fits well with the, you know, the sort of biosafety area. And then the final one is artificial intelligence risk. And this is something that I think, you know, most people, I did this, you know, sort of laugh it off the first time you hear of it, like the sort of robots taking over idea. But, you know, from the conversations we've had with people who know more than us, it certainly seems like something that could be the biggest technological change of the next 100 years, let's say. And it doesn't seem that any philanthropy or significant philanthropy is really devoted to thinking about how we should best address and manage this risk. And so that, you know, that's a final area that we're looking into. I mean, we've kind of now looked at what we think are most of the global catastrophic risks, and these are the three that we're sort of most worried about and most focused on, or at least tentatively most focused on for the time being. So I want to pause there and see if anyone has any questions on that on Give Well Labs.
Could you go into a little bit of why artificial intelligence is up there so high on your list? Like some of the research that you've done that make you put that as one of your top three things to focus on?
Yeah, so the question is, why artificial intelligence? I don't think I'm going to be able to give a great answer to that because I don't have the the right background. I would say that, we've looked at a list of the risks that, that kind of came out as global catastrophic risks. And so the ones I haven't mentioned, I mentioned asteroids. The ones I haven't mentioned so far are, these are always fun to talk about. Giant super volcanoes. So, for those of you who don't know, Yellowstone National Park is a giant volcano that goes off every 600,000 years. If it goes off again, we're in big trouble. That is one where it's not clear what, if anything, could realistically be done. I guess you could fund research into it. I think also just intuitively, we're more discounting the natural catastrophes relative to the human-created catastrophes with the notion that, hey, we've made it so far, so it's less likely to be as catastrophic as a man-made disaster. And then, another one is nuclear safety. That's one where our impression, we actually have a page on basically all of these on our website now, but it's one where there's significantly more philanthropic involvement. I think AI is the one that we know the least about, but it's certainly one that, of the full list of areas we looked into, was one that people pointed to as scary. And you'd have to talk to, you'd talk to someone else at GiveWell who could give you a more concrete answer about it. Yeah.
What about another risk, genocide? I mean, there's other government agencies in this country that recently there was a commission set up for the prevention of genocide. But I mean, have you considered that?
Right. So the question is, where does genocide fit in? Where does it? Right.
So it's hard for them to prevent it or set up a commission to prevent it just because the word is so good.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that I would, describe the global catastrophic risks are things that could it themselves significantly set back humanity, like broadly defined. So that's why something like an asteroid that wipes out humanity or some significant proportion of humanity or some pandemic that does the same, that's sort of what fits into this category, where they're just, very, very unlikely outcomes, but they would be so terrible. I think, genocide in that issue, we would put more into a different category, like a category of conflict between states and what can be done there. And that's, I talked about these four categories of causes. Another category that I didn't mention because it's kind of a one tier lower down on our current priority list is, things that involved like state level interaction or state level negotiation. And this is something where it is, the next step that we want to take there is get a better understanding of what philanthropy has or has not accomplished in the past in that whole enterprise. Because we want to better understand what philanthropy has done to get a sense of what it could do when you're talking about, state level discussion. Yeah. Avi.
Yes. So there are already a large number of think tanks that conduct economic policy research and policy advocacy. And I'm just wondering what do you, it seems to me like the area might already be saturated. What do you think that GiveWell might be able to add to that?
And so you're asking about like in macroeconomic policy specifically?
Right.
So the question is like, isn't this area already saturated? So again, unfortunately, I don't think I can kind of walk through the specifics of this. Like my understanding is that, so my understanding is that today, like the research being done is not sufficient given that, it's not the type of research that could be done. And something that you could look at is the, on our website, we'll post conversations that we have with experts. And so we've talked to a few macro economists who will say like, oh, well, this isn't being done. I think there is something happening now. I think one of the major think tanks is like setting up its own division explicitly focused on macroeconomic policy. And it's certainly possible that like that entity could resolve the issue that we have. It could like solve the problem, so to speak. But you know that's something that we're watching. I don't know whether that will happen or what you know they'll end up doing. You know, the final thing is I do think that like GiveWell's role would not be to, you know, do all of this research ourselves, but like fund the people who are doing the research or identify people to do, nudge them in the direction of doing a different type of research. And so I think the model that makes more sense is one where you say, like, the current research that is available or the current activity that is out there is not ideal. And then we could provide support to, you know, create an entity that is doing that type of work. Finally, I mean, it's just, this is sort of my own general impression that a lot of the think tank work often is like particularly partisan, and I think that leads to a certain type of analysis. And I think a goal would be to create a type of analysis that's less focused on like one particular agenda. So I guess everyone probably says that exactly.
Yeah.
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 Can you talk a little bit about where you are in like learning the lessons of how to evaluate the whole space of causes and like how to figure out which causes are actually the most important?
Sure. So the question is, you know, where are we at in kind of learning about how to learn about causes?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that like what, you know, what we're trying to do, I mean, the thing that we think is like really important is that we can't just stay at the highest level for too long just evaluating things, because we learn a lot about what it means to evaluate a cause by getting involved in that cause. And so in the case of, criminal justice reform, it's a really good example where getting into the details of the cause and meeting with, you know, learning from people like Mark Kleiman and Angela Hawken and then this other public charity, I mean, these are all things that we wouldn't have been able to do from afar. And so I think a lot of what we're learning is that it's necessary to go both broad and deep at the same time, even when, you know, we're at a point now where we're ready to go deep on certain causes, even though we're not at all confident that like these are the best causes or that we won't find better ones in the future. You know, and this is a lot of the way that GiveWell has operated historically, you know, where we've, from the very start, we wanted to find charities we could recommend, even though we recommended these organizations after only 3 months. Like, we knew these were not going to be the very best charities we could ever find. But by getting ourselves to sort of the end game of our research, we were better able to figure out what we needed to know at the higher level. Another part of this is something I sort of alluded to, this idea of being ready to commit to a cause such that you're able to learn about what exists in that cause. This is something that, you know, another thing we've tried in our GiveWell Labs activities, and this is something we'll be writing about a little bit more in the future, is, you know, we hired a consultant to go out and survey all the big malaria organizations about what projects, you know, they can't fund but would be incredibly impactful. And we got back all these proposals from these organizations. We ultimately decided that we weren't ready to move forward on malaria at the time. But one of the things we found is that, you know, when you go to an organization and say, can we solicit proposals from you? They generally only want to talk to you if they have an expectation that they're likely to get funding. And so this is very challenging. We try to be very explicit about the likelihood of funding, but you can't just sit back and, you know, I think that nonetheless, like that type of project that we did in malaria would not be feasible in like 20 other global health causes, because it just wouldn't be the way that the sector operates. And so, you know, part of what we're learning is you want to go do this deep dive to learn about what questions you have, but you also need to do the deep dive in order to get the information necessary to really understand what a cause looks like from the inside.
Yeah, so related question, the other side of the question, I guess. As you guys have grown and as you've interacted both with charities and you've seen how other charities have interacted with other donors, how much do you think that you're changing the model? Because I think that's one of the things that GiveWell donors are potentially excited about, is the fact that you guys are very focused on evidence-based analysis and you're doing the deeper dives. And do you see that model being adopted by other donors? And do you see charities responding to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see, we see some movement on the charity end of an interest in being more transparent. Certainly that's grown a lot as the GiveWell's Money Moved has grown. Money Moved is the money that goes to our recommendations as a result of our research. You know, I think there's definitely more of that. I don't think I would point to it as like changing charities' behavior is not something I would guess is going to be the way that GiveWell has its biggest impacts. I think it's actually on the front of like changing the model. I think that we're, you know, the place that I think we're more likely to influence is, we can't do this directly, but is funders. You know, basically, there's very little reason that funders shouldn't be more open with the work that they do. And in some ways, it's like quite unfortunate that we're trying to look at all these causes that others have looked at in the past, and we're essentially starting from scratch in looking at them. And so I think that's something where, I hope we can have influence. I hope that people start to do things differently. You know, certainly Good Ventures is following us in being very transparent. Hopefully they can also serve as a model. And I think you even see some movement on this with like the Hewlett Foundation has recently started publishing a lot more of the things that they're thinking about. And if I had to guess, I'd say that is really a very realistic way that you could create a much richer set of information about philanthropy than exists today.
So on that, to what degree, if at all, are you guys engaging in direct advocacy with philanthropy organizations, with donor groups, or donor networks, who are already engaged in some degree of advocacy for transparency among donors?
Yeah, so the question is, to what extent are we actively pushing this idea of more transparency among funders? We're not proactively doing this in any like major way. I mean, I think what we see... You know, the best thing I think we can do right now, beyond like obviously talking to people when they ask, and we've had conversations with groups when it has, you know, they thought it would be helpful, is just being a model of how this can be done. Because, you know, we've come up with a lot of processes around our traditional work and how we're transparent about it and how we protect confidentiality and the charity's interest and our own interest for transparency. It's more challenging, certainly on the political side, because you start to have a situation where, you know, you literally have someone who's on the other side who you're against, and it's not clear the extent to which you can share it. So I think these are things where there's still room for us to learn about, you know, what we can do, and then just by ourselves trying to be a transparent funder, showing others what, you know, what they can do. The final thing we're doing that is just kind of related to this idea is this something we call the History of Philanthropy Project, where we, you know, have hired some consultants to do a more like historical journalistic assessment of past philanthropic successes. And this is kind of very explicitly trying to go back to foundation activities or successes of 20 years ago, and saying like, how well did this work? What did they do? And the fact that it happened so long ago makes people more, more amenable to talking openly about their activities. All right, last question, or two questions, and then we'll wrap up.
Mine is right off the back of this one. It's just a clip. I just want a clarification. So, when you were talking about being against someone in this process, who are you talking about being against? What organization are you necessarily pitted against? Is it another organization like yours that's trying to, in a way, do the same thing, so they're trying to get some proprietary information?
Yeah, so let me give an example of like what it could be. It'll be a cause I haven't talked about much so far, but I think something that like I would say we're looking for are causes where there'd be like pretty broad agreement of the humanitarian benefit of like an issue, or at least, you know, we've written, people ask us often like, oh, well, GiveWell's research must be a function of GiveWell staff values. And like, this is true. And so we try to like write publicly about what those values are. And so where like our values would say this cause has humanitarian benefits, that's an area where, we're looking for. And then you might have some opposition that is not interested in the humanitarian outcome. They're interested in their own like personal benefit. So a good example of this is industrialized agriculture or factory farming. Like basically, you look at the situations of these animals, and I think the conditions that they have to have to go through are incredibly bad. The people on the other side of trying to create laws that prevent that type of activity tend to be the industrialized agriculture lobby. And so that's the type of group you're fighting against. And they're not a group that is, fighting against it for humanitarian reasons. They're fighting against it because that's, the activity they undertake.
Okay.
Ian, did you have a...
So you had alluded to this, I think, in a blog post, the idea that GiveWell might demerge into the GiveWell traditional organization and the GiveWell Labs organization.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah, sure. So the question is about the sort of long-term vision of GiveWell Labs and GiveWell and how they'll be, intertwined in one or two organizations. So these are clearly, in many ways, these are like very different research products. They're very different activities. And so in many ways, it seems like their being separate makes a lot of sense. We're also cognizant of the fact that getting involved in something like politics can cause a, harm to the sort of GiveWell brand, which is associated with more or less like unbiased, objective assessment of evidence. And so in many ways, like the long-term vision of these just being two separate organizations, both of which do research, both of which are transparent, is very, that is like very attractive in certain ways. So I'd say like our default expectation is like that is what will end up happening 5 years from now, let's say. That said, if I look back 5 years, it would be very hard to predict like where we are today. And so it's not unlikely that something changes. The main reason we haven't done this thus far is that right now our staff is, more or less flexibly allocated between both sides of GiveWell, and it would just create a lot of problems for us to try and do the research we need to do with an explicit staff split. And so for now, we've maintained ourselves as like one single organization. All right, cool. So I think about time to wrap up. I just want to say I really appreciate everyone's coming out to this very non-standard charity event. All of GiveWell staff really appreciate the critical engagement that we get with our research. It's, a lot of the reason that we want to put all this out there is to get this type of feedback and questioning, and we don't take that lightly. So thanks so much for spending your evening with me.